Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of An Imperfect Leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. Today, we're diving into the journey of a guest whose experiences navigating a predominantly white school outside her St. Louis roots really resonate with other crucial chapters in our nation's history. As my guest today describes her experiences, for me, the Boston busing program of the 1960s and 70s come to mind. In coverage by station WBUR, they quoted Michael Curry, and he said, "Sometimes you don't remember the word, you remember the sentiment behind it." And that is so true with my guest today. So let's fast forward to today. My guest, Dr. Sharonika Hardin-Bartley's narrative mirrors the struggles faced by Black students in Boston during desegregation. Thank you for joining me for this encore episode of An Imperfect Leader. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Sharonika Hardin-Bartley is my guest. Dr. Hardin-Bartley has served as superintendent of the school district of University City since July of 2016. And before becoming a superintendent, she was the assistant superintendent for human resources and leadership development for the Rittner School District. And before that, she occupied a number of leadership roles over 15 years for the St. Louis Public Schools. In 2021, she was awarded Missouri's Pierce Award. In January of 22, she was named one of five superintendents to watch nationally by K-12 Dive. And then, a month later, in February of 2022, she was selected as a prestigious Children and Family Fellow by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And Dr. Hardin-Bartley is from St. Louis. So as a Mets fan, I better not say anything disparaging about your Cardinals.
That's right.
So Dr. Hardin-Bartley, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here with you.
So before we get started, I should note that my son is a huge Cardinals fan. And as a Mets fan, he and I would compete quite a bit. And so when I was superintendent, if the Mets won, he had to wear my Mets hat to school. And if the Cardinals won, I had to tweet to 6,000 followers who were mostly just lobbying for a snow day that the Cardinals were a superior team.
Well, I'm sure that he had to wear that Mets hat very infrequently. So,
infrequently, that is that's exactly right, and he'll be the first to tell you that. So we know that you grew up in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Who were your influences growing up?
So I stand on the shoulders of Madeer, of Granny, my great grandmother, and my grandmother, who are no longer with me, and I also stand on the shoulders of my mom, Sharon Hardin. So amazing women, amazing Black women. Also, Miss Vaughn, my fourth grade teacher at St. Matthew's School. So that's who really influenced me and who continue to shape who I am as a human being and also as a leader.
So you mentioned your teacher as an influence. What was school like growing up for you?
So I had very different experiences. I grew up in St. Louis City. And if you know anything about St. Louis, one of our questions when we become adults is where should you go to high school? It might be that way other places, but we're very proud of that high school question. And we honestly use it in ways that are not so positive. But I attended Archdiocese schools, not Catholic, but attended schools at a very small neighborhood school in North St. Louis City. And had a great small community of learners, great teachers, Mrs. Vaughn, one of them, who just loved on us and told us that we could do anything and be anything, 100% African-American. From there, the DSEG program in St. Louis was starting. And my mom made a decision to send me to a far, far west school district in a district that I won't name, But a district that really let me know that there were other views about my brilliance in the world, and that everyone did not share the views and beliefs that Mrs. Vaughn held. So I experienced subtle bigotry. I did not realize it at the time because I was a kid. I experienced a culture of low expectations, not for all children, but for children who looked like me. And I learned quickly that I was different and that I was viewed differently because of where I came from and the color of my skin. And I think that both of those experiences have shaped my views around education and the power of educators.
So you use the phrase subtle bigotry. How is that similar from a term that many educators understand now as microaggressions? Are those similar? Are those different?
I think that I would say that the impact would be the same. I do think that sometimes with microaggressions, people are unaware. I think that the folks that I went to school with, the adults, were very much aware.
Subtle. It was intentional. It just wasn't incredibly overt, but it was
correct.
I understand.
Correct.
So
they couldn't do it too blatantly. Yeah. So it was, yes, that was the subtle part. But I do believe that there was definitely the awareness for most, not all. Some, you know, may not have been, but definitely more awareness was there.
So you mentioned that sort of helped sort of influence the way that you see the world, the way that you lead. And I'm curious about that. How has your leadership philosophy evolved, or I guess developed, because it sounds like it started pretty early?
So I think I live by, you know, a biblical scripture: to whom much is given, much is required. And that is from my grandmother and my great-grandmother, who really instilled that in me. Both had a high school diploma education that was as far advanced as they went educationally, but were the most brilliant women that I know. And they really instilled this spirit of service and this spirit of doing something with the gifts and talents that you have. So my journey has evolved as I've learned about my gifts and talents. I am naturally a people person. I love people. And honestly, I love little people. And in my journey, I have learned that I also must love big people, because our big people take care of the little people. So humility. When you work with adults, you have to be humble. It is so much not about me. So I am selfless in my pursuit. I have a focus on humans, on people. And I don't shirk that responsibility, nor do I shirk that focus. And I am human. So being human, I make mistakes daily. So the topic and your concept for the podcast was appealing to me. Yes, because you're my friend and I love you. But having this conversation, I think, is so necessary for leaders, particularly for leaders who look like me, because we do show up in a way that masks our humanity. And as a result, we're not our most brilliant and effective self. So that's been my evolution, understanding that this is who I am. And I bring all of my experiences, all of my lived experiences to the work. And as much as I aim to compartmentalize it, they make up the DNA that is Sharonica. And all of those pieces are essential for me to lead boldly and for me to lead in a fearless way, which is necessary in public education.
It was this idea of serving as that lead learner to admit when, or recognize when, we've made errors and to own them and work together to move forward. And it's true that sort of helped influence the title of this podcast to begin with. And so I do think that in leadership, and I don't really think it matters what industry you're in. I think leadership is leadership in a lot of ways, and that it may be defined differently based on certain terminology, based on that industry. But I think we're all battling this notion that we're supposed to be perfect.
It causes a little bit of emotion. There's a little bit of tension because I agree with it, but society doesn't allow it. My journey has been one that has been marked with a lot of criticism, a lot of questioning, And honestly, in some instances, unnecessarily, I feel that as a person of color and as a female, so gender and race are both factors that I hold and that impact how others view me and how others view my effectiveness. So this notion that I have to be 10 times as good, I have to meet a gold standard, and that gold standard is rooted in white supremacy, is rooted in a school of thought that doesn't embrace my humanity. So there, the trauma that I endure to aim to not make mistakes, because I only get one shot at this, and you know, I'm never going to be able to get over that mistake, when the human process of the journey of being human and being a learner, being alive, is about mistakes, and it is about learning from those mistakes. Yet I don't have the space to do that. So there's a lot that I hold and that I carry, so that I can do the work that I know I'm capable of doing for the community and children that I serve. So that term, it sits with me in a very pensive way. It excites and ignites emotions.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it, one in every four superintendents are women, so only about 25%. And then superintendents of color is only about 10%. And so this intersectionality, certainly the question is rooted in a degree of privilege that I get to ask, you know, how does an imperfect leader fit for you? And there are many more opportunities for me because of the way that I can pass, that I can make errors and people can say, well, you know, I know his heart, so it'll be good. Whereas for you, it's going to be, well, I knew it. I'm just fulfilling what I already believed, even though I just read all these amazing awards and recognitions, right? However, that doesn't, I mean, in a system of oppression that has been in place forever, well, certainly we know since 1619 on this
yep.
continent,
yep.
That there are systems designed to support and oppress. I hope the people listening don't leave yet. There's so much more to be discussed. So I wonder if you would consider this, though, that imperfect leaders are aware of how beliefs and attitudes influence the way that a system behaves, right? The system will generate exactly what it's meant to generate. And I've been so lucky to talk with so many amazing leaders all over the nation. And one thing that I have heard on more than one occasion is this, that overall, the people I lead want better outcomes for kids. They really do. It's the way we get there that we most often get stuck. And this very habit is described by the Water Center for Systems Thinking. And I love the question that they pose to leaders. How am I helping others see the influence that mental models have on our decision making? And so I wonder if you would just kind of consider that question. How do you do that? And I will say, in our past interactions, I knew I was in the presence of a thoughtful leader because you were someone who would see the moment for what it is, but then you don't want to stay there for very long. And yes, Richard Milner wrote the book, Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There. It's an incredible, incredible book. But what are some ways that you help people see how their mental models influence the decisions that they're making?
And, you know, so that's a great question. And as I've been on this journey, this is my 7th year in the system where I serve. And I was a brand new superintendent when I first started. So the leader I was 7 years ago, thank goodness, I'm not that same leader. I've evolved a bit, which is a good thing. We're really digging into asking the question around and looking at those who are most burdened by the system. And that's something in language and in a school of thought that I have garnered from my work with the Casey Foundation, really being intentional about who are we serving? Who are we aiming to impact? Who is most burdened by the system? And as a result of our efforts, our actions, not our words, not the policies, not the plans that we have, but our actions, who is being impacted or not as a result of our efforts. So using storytelling as a tool to build community has been powerful for our school community, really aiming to know the families and students that we serve and knowing them intimately and centering them in our conversations. having courageous conversations, honestly, in a way that builds community, but also in a way that causes discomfort, and being okay with being uncomfortable. And our storytelling as leaders helps us to know how we can best communicate with one another so that we can keep centering the populations who are most burdened. I have a revelation that I have concluded. There are mental models that are deeply ingrained and rooted in people. And no matter what I do as a leader, I am not going to change that mindset. For some, I can change how you behave. And so taking the conversation to action, taking the conversation to our agreed upon norms and outcomes, and that is moving us closer towards our target of truly humanizing our students and families through everything that we do. And if we're humanizing them, that means we value them, that we're loving them. We love them, their children, as if they are our own. And we're embracing every decision, every action, every planning meeting, every execution that we have with that spirit. And that can be powerful. If we continue to other and distance ourselves from the populations that we're serving, that's where those mental models, they're disruptive and they're harmful. And we don't see the progress. And I would say that in public education, we need to center our families and ensure that all of our actions and decisions are designed with their best interest and at the center.
I'm curious, just what do you mean by storytelling?
It is just that. You know, UCity was hit significantly by the flooding that happened in July. So July 26th and July 28th, significant flooding impacted many of our families. One particular student, a sophomore, he waded through water to help save a five-year-old. He's a sophomore in our district. That story, and this child has some other challenges. The adversity that our students overcome, the tenacity, the determination, the will that they have to just continue to strive despite some unbearable circumstances that many adults would never be able to navigate. And you mean to tell me we can't teach them how to read a third grade book? So I package that and just looking at our students from an asset perspective versus a deficit perspective. They have a tremendous amount of gifts and talents. And it may not be that they can show them in the way that we feel they should in that moment, but we can capitalize on that creativity, that innovation, that fire, that passion that they have to help them reach their goals. And as leaders, if we don't know one another's stories, we can't build community. All meaningful learning happens in a spirit of a relationship. There is some sort of relationship, good or bad. And if we want to maximize that, we have to know one another as human beings as well. So our storytelling also helps us to build bridges, to build coalitions of support, to see each other, to have more empathy. But when we use our stories to build community as a collective unit of leaders and leverage our students and our family stories in a spirit of strength and power, that's a beautiful thing. And if children only hear what they can't do, they only hear about their deficits, how is that joyful? How is that inspiring? And many of our children need those messages in a real and meaningful way. And they know they're below. They know they can't read. They know they have these challenges. And we can't consistently keep them there. There is so much more than their current circumstances. I always talk about things being a temporary state of being. And I say this to my students in the midst of significant, this is a temporary state of being. When they're dealing with significant adversity, what's next? And that's the storytelling piece that we really work towards in our district.
An imperfect leader, leadership in after action is supported by ILAA, a firm dedicated to supporting aspiring new and established leaders. For more information, please find them at human-centeredleaders.com. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. Our guest is Dr. Sharonica Hardin-Bartley, Superintendent of University City Schools. Now, in this segment, we ask our guests to just deconstruct a decision that they had to make, and then we'll discuss it. So, Sharonica, what happened?
So I was this is the vulnerable part. So I'm being very vulnerable here. I was a new leader, honestly, in the system that I serve. And I had a lot of assumptions that I had made regarding the system. There was a very intensive selection process. So there were focus groups and feedback received from families, from students, teachers, community leaders. I had read all of that information. I live in the community where I serve. My husband's family has grown up in this community, so we are very much connected to the community. I came in as a new superintendent, and I immediately began to say things like, we don't have that, and that's not in place. And what do you mean we haven't thought about that? And my intent was to demonstrate, one, as a new leader, that I knew some stuff about schools and that I was qualified to do the job. What was happening is I was devaluing the work of the team, and I did not have an appreciative lens towards the work, towards some of the systems, towards some of the great things that were happening. As a result, I alienated people. I caused people to feel silenced. They were not as comfortable sharing their true reality for fear of my racism. In my mind, I was getting all this information to make the system better. And the thing that I do well, which is build relationships and taking time to invest in people, I was doing the exact opposite of that. The aftermath was significant. Some of those relationships, they're better, but I will never get the opportunity to do over or to go back and engage in those meetings. And as I look back through my journals, because I'm a journaler, I'm pretty old school, I write everything down. As I look back through my notes and just position myself back in those meetings, I feel the tension and honestly the defeat of incredible people that I highly value and honestly respect. And so I work to make some of those situations right, the ones that I'm aware of. I'm sure there are many that I will never be aware of, because everyone didn't raise a hand to say, you know what, that was an ouch moment for me. And as a leader, I'm sure that I missed many interactions that could be molded or kind of made better. And so that's a hard lesson, but I felt like at the time I had to come in with this plan, and I had to come in and make things right and fix the system. And one person can't fix the system. And a great quality is listening, so, and knowing that sometimes you have to go slow in order to go fast, even though the work is incredibly urgent.
This is a really rich example. I think while the podcast is aimed at aspiring and early in their career superintendents, certainly for established, I think this is just such a rich example about you get the job and you also have a sense of urgency. I can similarly remember going into the job thinking, we have significant gaps and I'm going to tell them what our 8 goals are, which, by the way, if you're an aspiring superintendent or new to the job, 8 goals is too many. Like, when you're focused on 8 things, you're focused on nothing. And right. I remember standing up there saying, you know, and this is what we're doing. We're focused on this and we're focused on that. Entry into kindergarten, 3rd grade reading score. I mean, it was a whole list. And I'm sure I overwhelmed individuals. And I'm sure I sent a message that, aren't you lucky I have arrived? Because until then, nobody was thinking about these things. What was overlooked was this value of taking the time to meet with the different groups that exist within a system and outside a system to have a better understanding of saying, how can we do this together? And but what got overlooked sort of just from a system level, do you feel?
I think historical context. I mean, there are people who were busting their butts in this system. And the work of public education is so complex. There is no silver bullet. If there were, we wouldn't be engaging in dialogue about some of the challenges that we see. And I overlooked the need to listen. The need to listen, I would find myself, and I have video of it, which is even more painful because I can go back and look at me being a hot mess at these meetings. I was listening, but I'm like on the edge of my seat, ready to respond. So I'm really not listening. I'm already telling them what they're going to do and telling them what's next. And you could see people who were excited, and you begin to just see them do this. Their bodies just start to just shrink. And I overlook the impact that my power, because the position does come with power. And that is a dynamic that I don't agree with, but I am a superintendent and I understand that my role comes with power, more power than people think I have, but the position comes with power. And in some ways, I was a bit abusive with my power. And not intentionally, because that was never my intent, but intent versus impact is what another piece that I think I overlooked in those early days.
What did you learn about relationships?
Oh, they are everything. They are difficult to build, and teachers are a very gracious group. I love educators. We're very gracious. Once it has been damaged, it is difficult to rebuild it. We do not forget. And so it is best to go into those relationship building conversations with an open heart and mind and get it right as much as possible, because recovering, particularly in the role as a superintendent, the recovery time is significant.
Yeah. What frustrated you as you look back on this?
Honestly, I was frustrated with the process. I was frustrated with the people. I was very frustrated with the lack of clarity around things that I felt we should know. And I didn't understand the dynamic that I brought. People might have had more systems in place. I wasn't asking the right questions. So I was frustrated with my inability to ask the right questions, to guide people in the best way, and to help them lift the work. I was owning it. I'm the superintendent and I am here and I'm new, and you did a process and you picked me. And I should have been empowering and promoting and supporting the team who's doing the work. And I took that. I took that from them. And what happened, I ended up carrying the load, you know, and they were afraid to move because for fear of how I would respond.
Curious if you can recall an example where previously the team was working on an issue and you felt compelled to carry it, and then they're just sort of like, all right, I guess you're carrying it.
Many. I mean, many examples. I would say that one was our leadership development. I took it. I'm going to develop leaders, you know, by myself, one person. And it's impossible. And so the evolution of that, we just had our leadership session with our leaders, Transformation Leadership Institute. We're still engaged in that work last week. And I just showed up. I did a check-in and it was powerful and it was rich. And I had to let go and trust the team.
That's interesting. You know, you and I became better acquainted certainly through the transformational leadership work. And for those who are listening, University City, where I was in Columbia, Cardinal Ritter in St. Louis area as well, all engaged in trying to shift the way that our districts operate into a more of a shared leadership model. And that is not an easy concept to embrace. And I wonder whether or not your attendance, which was regular at the beginning, was restricting the ability for these other leaders that were in your system to really develop and begin to take it over, because they felt like, well, you're here, so I guess you'll tell us whether or not you like this or don't like it. And what I'm hearing is, because I don't know, is whether or not checking in was now that you've been able to sort of say, look, I don't need to be there every minute, because the great work that's going to come out of this is because we have collectively done this work.
So it's interesting that you said that. My team, they used two phrases that they would use to describe our interactions a few years ago. One was drop. They said I would have my drop moments. And what that meant was, if I said something, it was done. And that wasn't my intent. I would say something, but they perceived it as, okay, well, it's done. She said it, that's done. The other one was I would put a bow on it. So I would put a bow and it's done. Like, it's finished, there's the bow. So what I have seen is I am now more intentional about when I am present and when I speak. It's hard for me. And I talked about, you know, having to be 10 times as good and not having the option to not be perfect. So it's a lot with a weight with that. But I am intentional about saying, you know what, you guys have it. And the work was happening. And when I would pop in to join a group, not to facilitate it, not to lead it, they were still talking when I was present and they didn't look to me. And that's leadership. I mean, that is leadership. And to see leaders and central office staff that would not do an agenda without me checking everything on it, that were guiding and leading this rich conversation about our instructional core. Yeah, it was powerful.
Just beautiful.
Yep.
I sense that the next question is, what could you have done differently? I sense that it is very similar to what got overlooked. Yeah. Would you add anything else to what you could have done differently?
I think understanding that it is a process, and sometimes you need to go slow to go fast, and balancing the urgency with the importance of the work is a constant. And yet it is necessary to allow things to get a little messy. I don't like it. I didn't like the messy part of the process. And sometimes through the messiness is where the greatest innovation happened.
In the end, though, what was something that was good that came out of this entire experience?
What I saw last week, it was powerful. And what I am continuing to see with our CNI team, a lot of our work and improvements have been around CNI. And that was honestly a big area of opportunity for us, being an academic institution. It kind of is incumbent upon us to get that right. And we're seeing teacher leadership as well, because we're modeling collaboration. We're not perfect. We have a ways to go, but it is a much better space. And I am not driving it. It is my work is shifting. It's a different type of superintendency. But it's a good thing. I'm still busy, but it's a different busy.
Fantastic. So this podcast is designed to help aspiring early in their career and established leaders learn from the experiences of other leaders. And so with that in mind, what advice would you give to an aspiring leader?
This is cliche, you know, take your time. Don't chase a position. Really center yourself around your values and your beliefs, and the position will come. So know who you are and stand on who you are. Don't compromise your person.
And how does that differ from advice you might provide to an established leader who's now been in the job for some time?
Continue to know who you are. Do not compromise your values and beliefs. And stand, because who we are is all. I mean, that's powerful, and our convictions, our belief systems should not waver. Our approaches have to be situational, but our core, that has to be a constant. People need a constant, stable leader, and who you are and what you believe is that's leadership.
That is a really powerful statement. Thank you. Well, we are at the end of our time together, and so my guest today was Dr. Sharonika Harden-Bartley, and I just want to thank you so much for everything you have done for our profession, certainly in the state of Missouri, for being a personal friend who has always pushed me to be a better version of myself, and to always just be completely honest about who you are, what you believe, and true in terms of what you want for all children, what you're trying to create, not just for you, but what you're trying to create for all, and knowing that not one person can do it alone, that we do it collectively. It's an honor to know you.
Same here, Peter. Thank you so much.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.